Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Gardner, to my left, Justice Blyle. I'm Leanne Dofano. And you are the only case set for oral submission, so you will have our undivided attention. I don't think there's anybody else in the courtroom except us. So if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
May it please the court, I'm David Pearson from Fort Worth, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Pettigrew, Rodney Chase Pettigrew, who was convicted of capital murder with the death penalty waived. It was an automatic life sentence without parole. The 2 points or 3 points I'm going to cover, if there's time, is in point of error 1 and 2, extraneous offenses, and point of error 4 and 5, and 6, they're two different instances of confrontation clause in a hearsay argument, if there's time for that. Extraneous offenses and point of error number 1, this is, of course, well-tread ground under Montgomery versus State. The point of contention is two witnesses and also a business records affidavit, which contained an email thread between daycare workers of the child. This would be before the child, obviously, just a couple of days before the child was killed. They were commenting in this email thread that there was bruising on the child, they needed to watch him, that he had, quote, the face of fear, unquote, when Pettigrew picked him up, that there was a burn on his leg with explanations for that were conflicting. There was even a comment in there that he was crying violently when Pettigrew picked him up, that there was bruising on his left ear, bloody scabs on his right ear. This email thread and then the two witnesses that were in the email thread, it was very emotionally taxing, very almost melodramatic, the way we really need to watch this child and we're really worried about him with Pettigrew, although there was no evidence or no way that they could show that Pettigrew had actually inflicted any harm on the child. Of course, the court's well aware of 3836, and the state's allowed to go into prior relationship and state of mind evidence. But as has been upheld in Garcia and in Smith versus State and reaffirmed in Garcia, this state of mind relationship evidence must still fit a non-character conformity purpose. That is still a limitation. And I think when you look at this, the extraneous offense, that the state, it's not just a limited comment, it is two witnesses dedicated to it, and it is this email chain that goes on for 4 pages in this exhibit, exhibit number 54. The question is, did this prove any elemental or evidentiary fact that inferentially led to an elemental fact? And of course, our argument is that it did not. That it was the speculative nature of it, that there was to be fear, that they saw fear in the face of the child, was our contention is it was probative exactly for the reason that it shouldn't be probative or is not allowed to be probative, because it would make Pettigrew look like a bad guy in general, and that would be why it was informative or probative for the jury. If you look at the amount of space in the record dedicated toward this extraneous offense, it frankly doesn't compare well empirically where you look at the page numbers, but a lot of, as far as if you just count the page numbers in the record, but if you think about the fact that this was a case with a heavy on medical evidence, where there's a lot of testimony from doctors and cross-examination of doctors and nurses and so forth, EMTs, that consumes a lot of space in the record. So this extraneous offense, that's another reason this extraneous offense wasn't necessary, which is one of the proponents under Rule 403 has mentioned, even if it does not tip the scales to inadmissibility or if it falls into the scales of abuse of discretion on relevance under 404B, under 403, if you look at the well settled relevant criteria, It could go either way if it compellingly serves to prove a fact of consequence. I'll grant that. But does it have the potential to impress the jury in an irrational but indelible way? Certainly indelible, certainly. Again, it was unnecessary to the state's case. The medical evidence stacked up well for the state's theory. It was almost insurmountable the way it stacked up, where every expert that testified said this was intentional, non-accidental injury. Again, I've already referred to the amount of trial time, which is a little bit skewed, but if you think about the fact that so much of the trial time is towards the medical diagnosis of the injury, that should weigh in favor of the fact that it would be substantially more prejudicial, such that it would outweigh the probity.
His theory was that it was accidental, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And not intentional.
Yes.
And so you just said a minute ago you would grant that it tended to prove a fact of consequence. I didn't know what fact you meant.
I was trying to state, without conceding it, that on that factor under Montgomery versus State, the how compellingly it serves to prove a fact of consequence. Since the state pointed out in their brief, as you would expect, that in opening statement, the contention was made this was accidental by the defense attorney. So did they open the door, so to speak, to that being an element? And if this relationship evidence shows that the child was afraid of him, that might weigh in favor of the state, but I would say the other factors weigh in favor of Mr. Pettigrew.
What was the testimony that he was the child was afraid of him?
Well, the daycare director, Deb Spencer, and another daycare worker, Ms. Manikos, or something, I'm forgetting the first name, I'm drawing a blank on it, but they themselves testified. But then there's, again, this email chain.
Well, other than the emails, what was the cross-examinable evidence that the child was afraid of him?
That when he came to pick up, they went into in their email exchange and also in testimony that when the child was picked up by him, the child was clinging to the daycare worker, which was unlike him, they said. And he had, she put it as the face of fear. And then she also put it in her testimony, which this is her, I'm not mocking her personal faith, but her testimony and in this email chain was that the spirit in her let her know that this child was being abused, that something was not right with this child. It overplayed emotional content, whether, again, not mocking her faith, but it overplayed that to the point where it did fall into the territory under 403 of having very minimal probity but highly emotionally charged, which would encourage a fact finder to reach a decision based on emotional appeal, not on the bare fact of, well, do we have anything here to show that he was leaving the bruise on his...
Well, isn't it against the law to put a child with somebody who's a danger?
Yes, they...
Were they offered immunity?
That was never brought up. They never took pictures. It was a pretty fair short amount of time. We're not talking about the span of a couple of months. We're talking about...
No, I think any time. Isn't it illegal to place a child in danger? I mean, if it was as dramatic as it sounds like they described it in the emails and their testimony, were they offered immunity for placing the child with him?
No, not. I didn't try the case, obviously, but not that I'm aware of. And they even admitted it. The email chain concluded with, after the child is deceased, that, you know, gosh, I wish we would have acted upon this. I wish we feel bad about this. If there was some sort of self-loathing or self-condemnation in that regard. But no, it didn't. That would have been an excellent point of cross-examination, Your Honor.
When did the email start, this email chain?
In September of 2011. The child died in mid to late September 2011. And just that very short 2 or 3 week interval, 2 weeks out before his death, is the time period that it covers.
And there's an issue of preservation?
I think it would be curable or procedural default as to one of the issues, and I could be leaving some of this out, but I know as to the burn on the leg, there was testimony that the child had a burn that could have, that the father, or excuse me, Pettigrew gave the answer as it was from a car seat buckle that was hot. The mother said it was a flat iron, a curling iron, and I think that the witness even flipped that at one point. It's different in the business records, but the state did point out that the reference to the burn on the leg did come in through other testimony. It was referred to in other photographs. It was testified to without objection on that narrow burn mark. They have an argument that it was procedurally defaulted by not being objected to at every point it was brought up. The point of error 5 and 6, if I could blend that argument, because we're dealing with confrontation clause and hearsay, there was an affidavit from the Cook Children's Care Team, which the witness relayed that he had seen the affidavit, and that's it supported the fact that a crime had occurred. The question that was objected to timely was, and they tried to take out the hearsay, but in actuality, it does not. The question was, and again, without going into specific details, the information in the affidavit, do you believe it supported or did not support the fact that a crime had been committed on the victim? Of course, as the court's aware, confrontation clause has been called a bedrock procedural guarantee. The primary focus is whether or not this is testimonial. And of course, our contention is that when you have a care team at Cook Children that submits an affidavit, and it is beyond legitimate dispute that this would be testimonial, that this is medical personnel documenting historical facts. Law enforcement in these kind of cases is often on the scene, concomitant with the medical care going on. They are part of this, the group of professionals that's dealing with the matter at hand. And I think it stretches credulity for the state to argue that this is not testimonial. And in this kind of a case, if I could just, it sounds like a sidetrack, but it's not intended to be, where the child died of it as a result of abusive head trauma, which is, of course, formerly called shaken baby syndrome, and now just abusive head trauma. It is a rare type of offense where, unlike any other type of crime, and this is from a law review article by Professor Deborah Turkheimer in 2009, the Washington Law Review, entitled The Next Innocence Project, Shaken Baby Syndrome in the Criminal Courts. If I could quote her, it's very well put, unlike any other category of prosecution, all elements of the crime, mens rea and actus rea, which includes both the act itself and the causation of the resulting harm, are proven by science. Degree of force testimony not only establishes causation, but also the requisite state of mind. So with that as a background, if you have a law enforcement officer saying, I looked at an affidavit from the care team, the doctors at Cook Children, and does it support that a crime occurred? And he or she, the witness says, yes, it does. In this kind of case, that is testimonial. That is not a police officer. The probity of that, the force of that is from the truth of the matter asserted. This is not a police officer saying, I was dispatched to the east side because a man in a blue cap and a white shirt was committing a crime. It explains why he was combing the area for a man in a white shirt and a blue cap. This is, did a crime occur? Yes, it did. In this kind of case where you basically extrapolate guilt from the medical testimony and the last adult, if the child became symptomatic upon injury, upon the insult of the injury, which the doctors testified to in this case, if you're with that child, you're automatically a suspect. So I think it's far-fetched to say that The probity of this doesn't flow from the belief, the declarant's belief in the truth of the matter asserted. That's exactly why it's probative, and that's the only reason it's probative. It's probative that the law enforcement officer is able to just generalize in this one statement over a confrontation clause objection that, well, I reviewed all the medical doctor's affidavits, and they gave it to me in this affidavit, and it supports the fact that a crime occurred. By this point, after voir dire and opening statement, the jury would be well educated that if this was an intentional injury that was where the child became symptomatic right away and it was a crime, then whoever was caring for that child is definitely in legal jeopardy at that point.
Who was the affidavit submitted to?
Well, they did not introduce it, and the fact that's why
why did they make an affidavit regarding diagnosis and treatment? I mean, is that normal for hospitals now? Are they anticipating lawsuits? Or
it could be. It's that, of course, in criminal law, in criminal cases, of course, we see it all the time that if a child's been hurt and social workers are brought into it and CPS is brought into it, the doctors document in an affidavit whether or not what observations they've made, whether or not the injury to the child was non-accidental or not.
For purposes of prosecution.
Exactly, for purposes of prosecution.
Did that witness that made the affidavit testify? I mean, did the person who made
I don't know, Your Honor. It's impossible to answer because they didn't go have the jury step out to explore who's this affidavit from, who's it by. It was just couched in terms of, and Mr. Llewellyn can correct me if I'm wrong, but my recall of the record is it was just couched in terms of, I saw an affidavit from the team of doctors or from the hospital, and what do you think? Did it support the fact that a crime occurred? Yes, it supported the fact that a crime occurred, which, of course, not only is it confrontation clause, because we can't cross-examine the declarant, we never even get the benefit of knowing who was this declarant and whether it was a team or whether it was one person. My time's elapsed. Thank you.
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Are there any other questions?
I had a question about, you can address it on rebuttal, I guess.
No.
The aspect of the complaint that it was hearsay, it was backdoor hearsay, as you argue in your brief. And I wondered if you could elaborate on that a bit.
Well, the best case that I have for that, Your Honor, is it's the Schaefer case where the state actually used it in their brief as well, or in fact it is in their brief, but where the defense took the stand and said, I'm charged with possession of controlled substance, but I was just dealing as an informant for Officer so-and-so in the Abilene Police Department. This is in Schaefer. And so then the prosecutor called his investigator to say, did you have a conversation with Officer I forget the officer's name in this case, but the officer that supposedly was the paying this informant, this defendant, and he said, did he want you to drop the case? And he said, no, he did not. That's backdoor hearsay. The jury would know through the back door that this officer was not paying him to be an informant. That was it was backdoor hearsay. And then the same thing is happening here. They're trying to say that, well, don't tell us what's in the affidavit, but does it support that the crime occurred? It
tells them all they need to know.
It tells them all they need to know, exactly. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's another question.
Let me just ask about the flat iron. What's the significance of that?
Well,
the evidence that it was used on the child for a burn?
Yes, it was observed by the daycare folks. It was a burn on the leg. It was photographed. After the child was admitted to the hospital, a paternal grandmother also testified that she had seen the burn as well, and she thought it was from she actually was a hairdresser and said it was from possibly a curling iron. They actually questioned Pettigrew and the mother of the child about the burn, and they got conflicting stories about that, but they didn't photograph it. As far as the daycare, they didn't photograph it. They didn't try to remove the child or have the authorities alerted. They just noted it and testified as to that burn.
And as to who caused the burn?
There's no, well, they didn't, again, that's the very speculative nature of this. They didn't have anything, they didn't have a witness to say somebody admitted they did it or somebody saw Pettigrew do it. They just said the child had this burn, and we did not get consistent answers about it.
What, was there a stated purpose or a presumed purpose for why it was?
Well, the state did.
Admitted?
Under the 3836, the relation, it was the first thing that they argued, the relationship, the prior relationship of the child and the defendant, the state of mind, absence of mistake, accident, proof of intent. Those were the main focus of their 404B permissible purposes that they put forth to the trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll defer the rest of my time.
No. Thank you. Ed?
May it please the court. It's good to be with you here today. And Justice Baugh, I don't believe I've ever had the pleasure. It's good to know you, sir.
Well, it's good to know you.
Thank you much. Okay, I just want to start off by addressing your concern about what's up with this whole burn. There was a leg burn noticed a few days prior to the victim's death. It was first noticed by the paternal grandmother when she picked him up from daycare that particular day. It was brought to her attention by the daycare workers. Daycare workers asked the appellant, where did that burn come from? Oh, had a hot car seat buckle on his car seat, and he must have gotten burned when I strapped him in the seat. Mom, the next day, did you know about the leg burn? Where did that come from? Oh, yeah, I talked to the appellant about that. He said it was from a hot car seat, a hot seatbelt buckle. And she was like, oh, okay. So, no, I take that back. I'm misremembering. The first thing in the emails, appellant said he must have gotten a hold of his mama's flat iron. And that's how it happened. But he told his girlfriend, the victim's mother, that it was as a result of the hot car seat buckle. So we have the appellant telling two different stories about the cause of that, which occurred inferentially in his care. And that was the reason why we were offering that as an extraneous offense, was that to show that he had injured the child when the child was left in his care before, therefore it increases the possibility that he was the one who was directly responsible for the skull-shattering injuries that the victim suffered. And, of course, we had the 404B extraneous offense instruction in the charge, and that if the jury didn't believe it, they didn't have to believe it. But that was the whole premise of that. Also in this email chain, there was some talk about some scabbing and some bruising on one of the child's ears. Procedural default argument, both the ear injuries and the leg burn was introduced from several different other witnesses. Mother testified about the appellant's explanation for the leg burn. Actual photographs taken in the hospital of the leg burn were introduced, no objection. Mother's testimony about appellant's explanation, no objection. Grandmother's testimony about noticing it, caring for it, bringing it up with mom, and then blatant hearsay from mom about what she theorized might have caused it, the flat iron. None of that was objected to. We have an investigator who testified that that's why I went to the hospital and took pictures of the car seat, because the defendant to 911 and both in the interview to police, he's saying that the leg burn was as a result of a hot car seat buckle. Grandmother immediately, definitively said, my 38 years of being a hairdresser, that's a burn from a flat iron. Seen it hundreds of times. She testified to that, not the hundreds of times, but she just said that's a flat iron burn. Another point of error with regard to that, she was asked a follow-up question. Well, wasn't that your belief that it was a flat iron burn confirmed by folks at the church? Objection, hearsay. But then the very next question after that, part of my procedural default argument, was asked again, was your belief about the flat iron burn confirmed by other folks? Yes. So there's a plethora of evidence with regard to the extraneous offense that separate apart from the emails and the daycare workers' testimony. There's a plethora of evidence with regard to the defendant's different explanations as to how this prior injury might have occurred to the child that was not objected to for under extraneous offenses. The running objection only went to the two daycare workers' testimony.
You know, as far as the plethora of evidence that you referred to, when I looked at this case, it reminded me of the old saying that they threw in everything but the kitchen sink. And it seems to me sort of like the state threw in everything and the kitchen sink.
I believe that would be a fair characterization of the trial team. That's, I don't mean to be flippant, but that's kind of how we roll in Parker County. If we've got something, we throw it out there and let the jury make of it as they will. That was the theory of why this extraneous offense was put forth. That's the reason for the leg burn. No, we did not grant any immunity or entertain prosecution against the daycare workers for what you characterize.
Obvious, as the emails make it sound and their testimony, the face of fear, and he was terrified of him, and they had seen the burn. I thought it was a crime to put a child in a dangerous situation, which their testimony said it was.
Well, I disagree with your characterization, Your Honor, of the circumstances, or I guess the picture or portrait painted by the daycare workers as far as the level of dangerousness in the home or releasing the child to the mother's boyfriend. He was on the accepted list. He had picked up the child for months before. There had never been a problem. But 2 days before, the last time the child was there, this is how he acted. This is how he behaved.
Burn, face of fear, screaming.
Yeah, they had to pry him loose from the daycare workers, basically, is how I'd characterize it. He was not wanting to go with the defendant, and he screamed almost use a poor choice of phrase. He screamed his head off all the way out the door as he was being strapped in his car seat, and the appellant rode away. They had never seen that before, and that was the last time they ever dealt with him. So as far as intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly placing a child in a dangerous situation, I don't think it meets the elements.
I thought her spirit told her that the child was in danger.
Well, as soon as she saw that and the child drove away with the appellant, it weighed on her. She explained that in emails and a testimony, and that she prayed about it, and she discussed it with her supervisor, the director of the facility. What do we need to do? What do we need to do? And then about that time, they found out that he had suffered these injuries and then was dead the next day. So, like I said, that all happened within a period of 2 days. Now, the extent of the burns and being concerned, he didn't act that way after the burn. He had been picked up. He'd come in periodically over the preceding 2 weeks. He never behaved this way. It was just the last time, 2 days before he suffered the injuries, that he behaved in this particular way.
And you said there was a running objection to that to the email string
during the two daycare workers' testimony. Yes, Your Honor.
Did that objection go to their actual testimony or just to the
emails? Those objections were made during those two witnesses' testimony. The emails were prefaced before the first daycare worker was placed on the stand. State just stood up and proffered that, and then we had the whole argument, and it was admitted at that point. I interpreted it, this complaint was not only to the emails, but then to their testimony about the content of the facts contained within the email, and the testimony objection was by running objection.
Okay.
With regard to the procedural default argument, again, I contend that all of those same facts, he was scared. The grandmother testified about the boy being uncharacteristically clingy. He was a happy-go-lucky kid up until the time he was picked up with the leg burn, and that was just weird to the grandmother. Then with regard to the bruising on the ear, she also testified, no objection. So basically all of the material facts, which I think more particularly the conflicting explanations that the appellant's giving to various people about what caused this particular burn is what makes it damning, and that makes it significant and then therefore relevant. But all of this is also admissible because the appellant put his intent from the get-go into contest. We all know that just standing up and pleading not guilty doesn't put intent into issue. But when you stand up and say that this was all an accident, a horrible, horrible accident, I was fixing breakfast for my charge, and I set him on the kitchen counter, he fell off, and this is what happened. So I panicked, called 911, and then they took him off life support the next day. All of the evidence goes to show that it wasn't an accidental death, as Mr. Pearson pointed out. That the kind of force needed to cause these kinds of injuries are seen in traffic accidents, not a fall from a 3-foot kitchen countertop. And so just the nature of the medical findings themselves demonstrate that that this, I guess basically it's kind of toward my harmlessness argument, that the same fact was proven elsewise. If we're basically, if we're trying to admit an extraneous offense to prove that the defendant's story's untruthful, that he was the one that was responsible because it couldn't have been done by an accident, then as the case has shown that I've discussed in my brief, that if you introduce a pattern or a episode of prior abuse by the same person under similar circumstances, then that would be admissible to prove the particular intent. Also throw out motive, even though that wasn't in the court's extraneous offense instruction, is one of the proffered reasons. But under the cases, ill will or hostility from a defendant to a murder suspect or a murder victim is shown by prior instances of threatening or violent behavior. And here we have one 2 days before or so with a leg burn on his leg. Then you couple that with the child's reaction when he's being picked up the day before, or 2 days before his death, or actually 2 days before he has sustained the injuries, and then his conflicting stories as to why the burn occurred on his leg. That goes to show that he's the kind of person that would actually do that. Because it's always very difficult in child injury cases to get
over... Character conformity, is that what you're saying?
I apologize, Your Honor.
He's the kind of person that would do that.
I know, that sounds character conformity. But my point being is that an intent to harm a child goes against the normal human reaction. People don't want to think that someone would be capable of caving in the back of a little kid's head. And so we need to prove the intent, and when it was placed into issue directly, that's the whole issue of the trial, accident, a horrible accident or an intentional act. The jury obviously resolved that issue, but when intent was an issue, then you can't just look at that in a vacuum. Then on top of that, you have 3836 that allows us to get into the entire prior relationship between the suspect and the victim. And you have that. That's pretty much all we had. That's pretty much all the jury heard as far as prior instance about, well, he's given conflicting stories. We're getting different stories. We don't really know how that happened. We introduced pictures of the burn itself. The jury could infer for themselves. Introduced pictures of the car seat so they could see, well, is that burn match those car seat buckles? And so the jury could determine whether or not beyond a reasonable doubt we proved that the defendant's the one that was responsible for that burn. And if so, then you would apply it for intent, accident, absence of mistake, and there was another one, rebut the defensive theory of accident. So all of those permissible 404B reasons of showing why this isn't just strictly character conformity evidence that, well, he's the kind of guy who would hurt a kid, but it's the kind of guy who would hurt a kid on this particular event in question because it was a drastic, violent, intentional act. It couldn't have been caused by an accident, just from the medical testimony and the actual shattering of the back of the skull of a young person that apparently is very hard to do. Would you only have the victim and the defendant present, our entire case is circumstantial. So, I mean, just by nature of the beast. So that's, in my opinion, why not only were those first two issues not preserved, it was admissible to show intent and all the other permissible 404B's exceptions, and because the flip side of the procedural default, because all that evidence was admitted anyway, the same facts were there, and it's just whether or not the jury believed that it was properly proven extraneous offense. With regard to the points of error 5 and 6 about the affidavit, I'd like to remind the court that this was all in the context of walking the investigator through his investigation. What did you do this day, Investigator Montgomery? What did you do next? Did you go to the hospital? Yes. Did you talk to the folks there? Yes, I did. Were you communicating that information back to the deputies that were in right that second interviewing the suspect at the sheriff's office? Yes. Or I'm sorry, it was actually the Azle Police Department. Did you then communicate to that? Yes, I did. And then the next question, right after the objected to question, did you do anything else of consequence on that day other, at that point? He goes, I can't recall. Well, then what'd you do the next morning? The next morning, I helped with to get the affidavit together to get the arrest warrant, and then I was present there when we served the arrest warrant on the defendant. This is, in my opinion, a textbook example of information acted on. It's not technically an exception to hearsay. It's just by definition not hearsay.
And he didn't say he acted on it, though.
Not directly. I would agree with you. Yes, Your Honor. It's just basically, you got this affidavit? Yes. You passed it along? Yes, I did. Did it support your belief that a crime had been committed? The crime was unidentified. The suspect was unidentified. any particular contents or specific information contained in the affidavit wasn't related by that information. The affidavit itself was never introduced. They produced those affidavits to get PC for an arrest warrant, is why the officers, or is why hospitals produced those affidavits.
The hospital created the affidavit to provide the probable cause for the warrant?
That's why they produced those affidavits, yes. The kid comes in, he's a suspected victim of injury, of abuse. That's what the care team investigates, that's why they exist. Do these injuries meet, are they consistent with allegations of abuse or not? If they are, they produce an affidavit to provide to law enforcement. Here is basically your probable cause on the medical findings that we're determining here at the hospital to go forth and get a warrant if that's your intent. And the warrant wasn't introduced, the affidavit wasn't introduced, and the director of the care team herself, Dr. Jamie Kaufman, was called as a witness at trial. She was subject to cross-examination, and if you want to get technical, the actual question itself, do you believe, officer, that this supports or does not, he was on the stand. His belief and his response could have been subject to cross-examination. So I don't see any confrontation issue. Also, you can't get to the confrontation issue unless you think there was a hearsay problem. And I submit that by definition, this wasn't hearsay because it's information acted on.
But he didn't act on it. He did not. He said he couldn't remember whatever.
Well, he couldn't recall on a specific event after that day. That was what the trial testimony was. But because of the context, and you can infer that was basically another piece of evidence that he gathered in the midst of his investigation that ultimately resulted in the arrest of the defendant. It was generalized information. It was a generalized hit and miss description of what information he obtained, not the content of the information. And in those situations, the courts have said that that's an information acted upon. That's not hearsay. Doesn't run afoul of the hearsay rule. If it's not hearsay, then you can't violate confrontation. But even if you think or are troubled with the confrontation issue, the head of that particular unit that produces those affidavits did testify, gave her medical opinion, and was cross-examined.
Not the person who made the affidavit.
I believe her testimony, it's exactly right. I believe Dr. Kaufman was not the affiant.
So she wasn't the person with personal knowledge.
To my recollection, that's correct. But I think she said it was one of her nurse practitioners or one of her examiners. She wasn't on duty when he came in. She just reviewed the information of the nurse and reviewed the affidavit, and she talked about basically, my medical opinion matches those of the others, that this was an intentional as opposed to an accidentally caused injury. But I'm just saying, as far as if the defense had a problem with the care team's conclusions, care team representative, the person who was there, who was the expert, was subject to cross-examination and was actually cross-examined about issues like
that. But not the person with personal knowledge who actually made the affidavit.
That is true. And again, but none of the contents of the affidavit were actually elicited. We didn't introduce it. And in the question itself, the officer was point-blank told up front, now not getting into any specifics, just want to know, is the information contained in that, do you believe support that a crime had occurred? And he said, yes, I do, over objection. So unless there are any other questions.
I just wanted to ask, earlier in your argument, you said something to the effect of that's just the way we do it in Parker County. Would it be fair to imply in a parenthetical the words regardless of the rules or the law?
No, Your Honor, of course not. I'm just saying that if we have a piece of evidence, we're not in the practice of eliminating or preventing the jury from hearing evidence that we believe is relevant. And if we have a piece of evidence here, the extraneous offense, that we felt that met our theory of the case, we presented that. But no, I would not believe that would be a fair characterization, that regardless of the rules or whatever, I mean, ultimately the judge has to allow us to do what we want to do. But we play by the rules, and that's what I'm saying, is we're erring on the side of oversharing with the jury by placing that in front of them and then letting them see. It's just here that particular prior extraneous met our theory of the case and goes to the evidence of intent and all the other permissible 404 uses of that evidence. But no, I would not characterize that, no. Because again,
concern yourself with oversharing inadmissible evidence?
No, sir. I would not characterize that, and I can't think of one off the top of my head. And if it was inadmissible, I guess what you're saying is that if the judge allows us just to let us do whatever we want, we just do it? No, sir. I would not agree with that characterization if that's my correct understanding of the where your question's coming from. No, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
David?
May it please the court, just briefly, and I'm not trying to sound small or petty, but the Parker County way, I do have to address that just for a moment. There is a case that I happen to have tried and appealed in the early 1990s, Nolan versus State, volume 870, I don't know what page, but Nolan versus State, and it's one of the rare 404B cases where the 404B evidence, this court held it was not even relevant. In other words, the oversharing of this extraneous offense, which was a drug possession case of a lot of amphetamine, where the defendant in the case in chief, the state went into another accusation in another county where he and a bunch of conspirators broke into the sheriff's office and stole all the glassware to manufacture methamphetamine. This was introduced in the state's case in chief. And this oversharing, this court held, and it was affirmed, PDR was denied, that it wasn't even relevant. It didn't even bridge the gap of being relevant. They never even reached the question of 403. And I do just want to slow down for just a moment if I have what little time I have left. I do think that it's a sidestep, and it's clever, but it's not lawful. It is a sidestep to say, to ask a police officer, where in this kind of case where the medical evidence is so insurmountable and so vital, and the doctors and team of nurses, the doctors and the radiologists and so forth are saying this was non-accidental. A police officer being asked, and mind you, by this time they'd heard 3 hours of an interrogation, was an interrogation technique, and of course this was over objection. Mr. Pettigrew was told over and over again, well, the doctors are telling us that this was not accidental. The doctors are telling us that this is what you're telling us is not going to fly. This is what the doctors are saying. Of course, he made the objection to no avail. But mind you, by this time, the jury has listened to 3 hours of this where detectives are saying over there at Cook, which granted, Cook should be regarded as a beacon on the hill where the people there are so smart and so gifted. Over there, they're telling us this is intentional. This is what they're saying. Those smart doctors are saying that. So it is piling on, and not only in point of error number five, but in point of error number four, they did it again where they were asked, the interrogating officer was asked, when you were saying to him these medical statements we were receiving that it was not accidental, was that a true statement? I mean, that's not exactly what the question was, but they asked him, when you were saying that in interrogation, was that true? Oh, yes, that's true. The probity of that is exactly because the police officer, believed in the truth of the matter asserted. And this, so this sidestepped of, it's not a confrontation clause violation because he's there to say, I believed in this affidavit, it's a sidestep. It is, you'll look at the case cited in the brief of De La Paz, where they brought in medical records that had the declarant's outcry, and they introduced them into the records without naming the declarant there or being subject to cross-examination. The Court of Criminal Appeals said this was error. Well, back to this case, The officer cannot in good faith say that he was answering that question to say that I acted upon this information. It is not a needed point to make that I acted upon that information. He's being asked twice, in two different instances at least, to say, I believe that the doctor's telling us this was non-accidental, was a true statement. That's so that, and again, like Mr. Llewellyn just said, we don't even know, it wasn't Dr. Kaufman, we don't even get the benefit of knowing who this was, much less exposing the cross-examination. And so I think it's a slippery slope. We're dealing with somebody that's doing life without parole. And it's a slippery slope to make the argument that because he's there to say, I can answer all the questions in the world about why I believe it. Well, I'm just a lawyer. He's just a police officer. When he's telling the jury, hey, the smart doctors over there, and they are. I'm not being sarcastic at all. I'm talking about the weight the jury would give this. When he is being allowed to repeat twice in direct questions about this affidavit and about these medical statements, when he's able to repeat twice, they're telling us over there this is not accidental, then I'm sure you could hear a pin drop in the courtroom. If that's what all the doctors are saying, from a lot of people, that's good enough. And back to this extraneous offense where they're saying we're oversharing, there is no need for any of that. No need for it whatsoever. They already had this insurmountable medical testimony that lined up almost uniformly that this was non-accidental. So unless there's any other questions.
I have a couple.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have a couple of questions. Still on that subject, under the theory that the police officer could say he believed the affidavit was true, or whatever it was he said, couldn't a detective, and you're not arguing for the detective, I know, I'm just theorizing, detective collect several affidavits in some case against a defendant and then review them, like statements from witnesses, statements from doctors, depending on the crime, and say, I've reviewed all of these statements and I believe they're true, and that'd be the state's case.
No, that's classic hearsay. The inconvenient fact for the state is when you say, a police officer could say, I've been gathering information and I've decided to present a warrant affidavit to the magistrate or the judge. That's different. That's not naming anybody. I gathered information. And you can even say, I talked to doctors, I talked to the school teacher, I talked to the defendant. And, of course, implicit in that was the information he gathered, he thought there was probable cause for a crime. But the problem here is this is crossing the line into, I found other people that aren't here, they cannot cross-examine. I found them credible, and I found what they were saying to be true, and therefore I relied upon their affidavit when I presented this criminal case. It crosses the line, and it crosses confrontational clause of infringement is what it crosses.
Okay. The other question I had was, I think you said the interrogation of the defendant took about 3 hours, but I can only find about 70 minutes of Exhibit 31 and 32. Is there someplace else that the rest of it appears?
I'm just going from what the I could be misstating that it was 3 hours. Might have been what they were talking about as far as the length of time they spent in court presenting it to the jury. I could be confusing the publication with the amount of actual time that the interrogation lasted. I apologize if I did.
It does look like it's broken down into several parts.
There was a break where they allowed him to take a smoke break, and that was where they changed the recording device or the disc, and it ended up on two discs, I think 31 and 32, but it is one interview.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Sir?
Right. Oh, sure. Kenneth Allen Nolan. Thank you. All right.
Sorry?
He was saying the name of the case I cited was Kenneth Allen Nolan.
Kenneth Allen. Oh, okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate your argument. Appreciate you coming here today. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business.